The closing market report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to cooley at admworld.com.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for July 19th, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And later this half hour, we'll have cash grain analysis with the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. In agricultural news, the Senate Majority Leader wants to push forward with climate change legislation. Todd Gleason reports on newly released news of a new type of herbicide resistance. And in the second part of the show, The Farming World, heard on many of these stations, will dip into the archives for an interview with David Ray of the American Meat Institute. It's all on the Monday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Rob O'Malley in Champaign at 217-378-7633. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Here's how prices settled on Monday afternoon in Chicago and Kansas City. In Kansas City, September wheat, $5.95 and a quarter, down 3 3/4. December, $6.12 and a quarter, down 3 1/4. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, $5.82 and a quarter, down 5. December, $6.11 and a half, down 4 1/2. March of 2011, $6.33 and a quarter, down 3 1/2. September corn, $3.81 and a half, down 13 1/4. December, $3.94, down 13 1/4. March, $4.06, down 11 3/4. May, $4.13 and a half, down 11 1/4. July, $4.20, down 10 1/2. August beans, $10.08, down 11 1/2. September, $9.86 and a quarter, down 11 3/4. November, $9.72, down 13. January, $9.80, down 12 1/4. August soybean meal, $3.05, down 2.80. August soybean oil, $37.96, down 35. August live cattle, $93.12 and a half, up 85. August feeders, $114.42 and a half, up 132 and a half. July lean hogs, $77.96, up 110. And those are today's settlements in Chicago and Kansas City.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Looking at meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights, he says high heat and humidity will continue through the next 2 weeks. No extremely hot weather is expected, but the heat indices will continue oppressively warm, especially in southern parts of the region. Showers and thunderstorms will occur frequently through Friday. Heavy rain is likely from northern Iowa into northern Illinois and east into northern Ohio over the next few days. Relief from dryness is likely in central Illinois later this week. Some cooling will occur briefly this week, but the heat will be back next week. Temporary drying during the weekend will be replaced by more rain chances next week, and crop development will continue to advance favorably over the next 2 weeks with a few pockets of dryness.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. Good afternoon, Kurt. Good afternoon, Kurt. Hello, Kurt.
Dave.
There you are.
Hello.
Well, let's go ahead and look at the marketplace. And I kind of thought that maybe, just maybe, there was an outside shot that we might see something wheat-led at some point throughout the day. There was some fundamental news about Iraq buying some wheat from the U.S. and also bought wheat from Russia, Australia, Canada, and Romania as well. And then the weather problems over the weekend in Russia. I thought maybe there was a shot at it, but it wasn't meant to be.
Well, that's what we need, is some fundamental demand to come forward and support the rally. The weather rally has been supply-driven, and supply-driven markets are hard to hold, especially when weather starts to cooperate a little bit or the speculative crowd gets loaded up, for say. So we're going to need some solid fundamental demand. Some of that demand, though, that comes forward might be last-minute booking, being spooked. If you go back to the weather rallies in the 70s and 80s, oftentimes the foreign business comes forward and buys on panicness, and that usually puts a high in the market. So we basically need some longer-term demand. But the fear that some of these world wheat numbers are going to come down has been the catalyst. That's why wheat's rallied $1.50 here off the June lows, and why we've seen so much interest in the wheat market. We got to remember, old crop carryouts are ample. Even if we don't raise a whole lot of wheat in the coming years, we still got half a year supply sitting in bins ready to go to the marketplace. We've been bullish wheat, and we've gotten the rally now. Now it's probably time to make and consolidate here a little bit. We felt that wheat was the next bull market, and it's starting to take hold, but with the run-up we've seen, we're probably due to pull back and retrace someday.
I figure that traders have already factored in what they believe will be this afternoon's crop progress report. What are they thinking?
Well, mixed ideas. Some are looking some slight improvement. Others are looking for, you know, a little deterioration yet. Definitely today's rain event's not going to help on today's report, but there's some needed rain around that's going to help benefit the crop in some areas. For the most part, I expect anywhere from 1 to 2% either up or down. I don't see a huge swing either way.
I would think that maybe bean conditions may have slipped a little bit because we had a lot of heat last week, but maybe I'm wrong on that.
Well, it depends where at. If you have some moisture to work with, you know, those are going to improve. But if you've been like us here locally, been missing the rain, you're definitely going to see those beans be at a standstill.
So I imagine you've been getting a lot of calls today from producers who saw this, well, weather drop, and they're saying, well, how do I play it?
Well, we get a lot of calls every day. Every day is a big day for us. I mean, it's a dynamic market. There's a lot of movement, a lot of excitement for the bull and the bear both. But if you go back in history, whenever we see moves like this, supply-driven or weather-driven, when it's hot and dry, the market goes up, or fears of some weather, well, whenever you remove that fear, the market quickly goes the other way. So we'll see what the weather forecast brings us here in the next few days. But for those needing rain, they get rain. That's not bullish. So we're in a situation where weather markets are brutal, they're volatile, and, you know, if you didn't get stuff sold, we would probably use, you know, renewed concerns to get some stuff sold.
I suppose other than weather, the biggest thing that we need to start thinking about again is yield. I know crop production reports coming out and sort of the beginning of August, and people are beginning to have their ideas about that. And I hear a lot of people think that the acreage is just flat out wrong on the soybeans. It's way too high. Can you make a case for that?
Well, we're going to argue acreage and yield clear into next January, then they'll probably change it clear next spring. That's what's going to make the market up and down. Everybody's going to look at the crop conditions and plug in their yield and so forth. The biggest work we have to do, well, we've been saying this for the last month and a half, is harvested acres, how they're going to just harvest acres. There's a lot of holes out there. There's a lot of crop that's dead. I don't care if it's GMO or not. It's brown. It's gone. So, you know, that's the big debate now is we'll probably keep a good yield on there, but at some point in time, I think the report's going to show a smaller harvested acre number, especially on beans.
It may take a while.
Yes. You know, we've gone through this before.
Yes.
Where we've surveyed and then resurveyed, and we'll do a special survey, and it's a long, drawn-out process. So the key is don't get caught in the market in a position where you're hoping and wishing for the market to bail you out. You got to use the market to your advantage whenever the opportunity arises.
What else would you like to share before we let you go today?
Well, it's a brutal market. It's a dynamic market. It's not over yet. The market did hold where it needed to hold. So we'll see if Wayne Nelson's turnaround Tuesday kicks in here tomorrow to see if we revisit those highs. But the key is having some type of battle plan in place to be prepared for moves like this.
Thank you very much, Kurt.
Very good day.
That's Kurt Kimmel, and he is with Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
In agricultural news, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he wants the Senate to debate an energy bill later this month. But senators are still cobbling together all of the elements that might be in that bill. Among the outstanding items is just what role agriculture will play in carbon offsets or renewable energy. The latest scaled-back climate bill focuses largely on capping greenhouse gas emissions from utilities, but keeps the combination of allowances and offsets that create a cap-and-trade plan. Farm Bureau remains firmly against the cap-and-trade strategy. The International Energy Agency today says that China is now the world's biggest energy consumer, knocking the U.S. off a perch it held for more than a century. The Paris-based agency says that China devoured a total of 2,252 million tons of oil equivalent last year, or about 4% more than the U.S., which burned through 2,170 million tons of oil equivalent. The oil equivalent metric represents all forms of energy consumed, including crude oil, nuclear, coal, natural gas, and renewable sources such as hydropower. The CME says that it's too early to assess whether a fix to encourage convergence in its wheat contract could also help improve performance of Kansas City Board of Trade wheat futures. The CME told a U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission subcommittee meeting that it has seen signs of better convergence between wheat futures and cash prices at expiration. But panel members said they need more time to watch how the contract performs. Millers and commercial grain companies have long complained that if the cash and the futures prices do not meet at some point, it makes it difficult for them to hedge price risks. In response, the CME instituted its much-debated variable storage rate. But some complain the VSR favors growers and grain merchants who have wheat to sell at the expense of millers, exporters, and other buyers, skewing supply-demand dynamics and shifting the convergence problem to deferred months. The Consumers Federation in Taiwan is trying to place the issue of imports of U.S. beef on an upcoming ballot to let the people decide whether to open the market. The organization reportedly has collected some 100,000 signatures in favor of the referendum, but about 860,000 are needed before the issue can be placed on the ballot. The deadline for collecting the required signatures is August 10th. If the referendum were to be successful, the action would have the effect of vetoing Taiwan's reopening of that market to U.S. beef and forces a renegotiation of the protocol negotiated earlier with the United States. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. Illinois this morning released news of a new type of herbicide resistance. A population of water hemp in the state was suspected last season of having developed resistance to HPPD inhibitors. University of Illinois Extension weed scientist Aaron Hager held a conversation about the resistance earlier today with Todd Gleason.
What can you tell me about this population of water hemp in the field in Illinois and new resistance that is developed?
This particular population is one that we've worked with both in greenhouse and actually in the field during the 2010 growing season. We were alerted to its existence late last year, well too late to do anything in the field, but we were able to get some seed collected and begin our investigations of it in the greenhouse last winter. And in essence, what we've found is that the population is not adequately controlled with several of the foliar-applied herbicides that target the HPPD enzyme. These products are commercially available in various herbicides, things such as Lotus or Impact or Callisto would be some examples of products that these active ingredients are a part of. And what we've found is that either under greenhouse conditions or under field conditions, that the plants are simply not adequately controlled with labeled use rates of these products. In the greenhouse, when we did the experiments and had two known sensitive populations there for comparison, all the plants in the sensitive population were completely controlled, whereas the ones from the field location where we had collected the seed from were not adequately controlled at all.
If memory serves me correctly, Callisto hasn't been out for very long, and I just don't know about this. Was that the first one that did was an HPPD?
That was the first. Yeah, that was the first of the foliar applied. Isoxaflutol or Balance was one of the first ones in the soil arena, and that was out back in the 1990s. I think 98 or 99 was when it came into the market. Callisto came on in 2001. Somewhere in there, I think, Todd.
All right, I was just trying to get an idea of how long it took for the weeds to develop resistance to this. Do you have an idea? Do you know whether this field was sprayed with this active ingredient?
Yeah, this is a good point, too. The field that the population was identified from was actually in seed corn production for many years. And for most of the years, at least recently, the field was treated multiple times across the years or even more than once per year with this particular line of chemistry. So the selection intensity to find resistance to HPPD inhibitors was very, very high in this instance. You know, this is something that we're going to continue to investigate. We've got quite a bit of field research that we've completed this year. We're going to continue to do our greenhouse and laboratory research. Many of the things that we're ultimately striving for is to understand what is the mechanism or mechanisms that allow these plants to survive these applications of this herbicide family. And then also, based on what we're able to accomplish from the research, be able to come up with some recommendations to manage these populations. We obviously were aware of this one particular population, but really do not have any indication that this may be the only one in the state. It's you know, altogether likely there could be other populations. This is one that we know about. So we'll move forward with trying to understand what we can with this particular population and with the assumption that there could be other populations around the state for which farmers are going to need some recommendations for their management.
All right. Thanks much, Aaron.
All righty, Todd.
That was Todd Gleason speaking with University of Illinois Extension weed scientist Aaron Hager about a just-confirmed HPPD-resistant population of water hemp in the state. Details of the confirmation can be found on the web. Search Google for the letters IPM and the word bulletin, or visit bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Joining us now with cash grain analysis is Greg Johnson of the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. Good afternoon, Greg.
Good afternoon, Dave.
I keep thinking, and maybe it's just me, that with all the corn that still needs to be shipped down at the Gulf, over 300 million metric tons, and how much corn that they have down there that is less than ideal, is of number three grade or worse, I keep thinking, will there be a play prior to harvest or not, perhaps for number two corn? Or do you think that the corn coming off early harvest in Texas and such will just handle it?
Yeah, a month ago, that could have been the case, and it still may be, but with all the growing degree units we've had, there is going to be corn, you know, ready in September against that September contract. So it's going to be interesting, but at least the people that are short contracts versus the SEP have a fighting chance of finding corn to source that during the month of September. But for people that need actual cash corn in the month of August, that new crop corn is not going to be ready then. So there's going to be a definite scramble to find corn during the month of August, good corn. I mean, there's plenty of number three and worse, but to find number one or number two yellow corn in August is going to be quite a chore.
So you think that there might be some basis improvement?
Yes. For good quality corn, I think you'll see better basis levels. You know, there's a lot of people that have corn, but if it's not number two yellow corn, some of the places, elevators, farmers have made that decision to just store that corn into the fall and blend it with the new corn. So, you know, that corn basically is off the market. So if you have a lower supply, which effectively you do have, that should mean better basis levels.
Of the people that you primarily work on, how far along are they in their new crop marketings?
This rally, this 60-cent rally that we've had since the June 30th report has given quite an opportunity for people to get anywhere from 50 to 65% sold. Not everyone has done that, but it has given quite a few people that chance to do that. For the ones that don't have storage and need to get some sales made, I think this has been a perfect opportunity to get that done. I still think we'll see higher prices on down the road, but that may not be until next Jan, Feb, and March when we try to buy acres. So, you know, I don't think there's any rush to sell new crop corn, and definitely no rush to sell the 2011 or 2012 crop yet. But for people that need to sell old crop corn and sell parts of their 2010 crop, I think this is a perfect opportunity to do that.
What about your prices today?
Cash corn tonight is going to be $3.69. New crop corn, $3.64. January, $3.86. Cash beans are $10.17. Right out of the field, $9.52. January, $9.55. Old wheat, $5.57. And wheat for next July, $5.98.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Dave.
That's Greg Johnson of the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. And in 2 minutes, I'll be back with a look at agricultural weather. It's National Daiquiri Day. The cocktail was supposedly invented around 1900 in a bar named Venus in Santiago, Cuba, about 23 miles east of an iron mine by a group of American mining engineers. It's also St. Vincent de Paul Day, patron saint of horses. On this day in agricultural history in 1104 was the first Flinch Day. A married couple who can prove to a mock court with a jury of bachelors and maidens that they have not had wished themselves unwed are awarded a flinch of bacon that's half a pig. The origins of the custom are in Dunmow, Essex, England. Details are not certain, but references to it go back to 1104. It has been a regular civic event in Dunmow since 1855. And it's now held every 4 years and is frequently televised. In 1814, Samuel Colt was born, an American firearms manufacturer. He made popular the Colt 45. In 1863, Curtis Marbot was born, an American geologist. He was one of the founders of modern soil science. From 1895, he taught geology at the University of Missouri, while also working for the Missouri Geological Survey and directing the Missouri Soil Survey. In 1910, he left Missouri and was a soil scientist for the U.S. Bureau of Soils for the balance of his life. And that's this day in agricultural history. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us for our look at the agricultural weather is meteorologist Mark Russo of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. Good afternoon, Mark.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Well, it's all about the ridge. Everybody's talking about the ridge. Where is the ridge? Is it moving? Is it not moving? And we're all trading the ridge this week.
Well, Dave, the ridge is an oscillating feature across the country, and it is an elongated area of higher pressure, so it's really not concentrated or anchored down over one specific area, but currently it's elongated primarily from the southern plains eastward to the southeast, and as we go through the week, it's going to remain in that general feature here, positioned across the southern U.S., and then as we get into week two of the forecast, we do see that ridge actually becoming a bit less elongated and becoming concentrated out over the western portion of the country. At no time here, at least over the next couple of weeks, does it appear that it'll be directly over the Midwest. So as a result, we don't see any kind of widespread extreme heat moving into the Corn Belt here, although, you know, temperatures will still remain warmer than average, more so during the nighttime hours because of the high humidities and dew points in place. And then with the southern displaced ridge, or at least being located over southern U.S., this week's going to be on the active side with several thunderstorm complexes developing on almost a daily basis here from now through Friday, and that makes this week a pretty active week for rain activity in the Midwest.
Mark, when you add it all up by the end of the week, can you quantify about how much coverage over and over how large an area?
Yeah, for this week, specifically in the corn and soybean acreage in the Midwest, we're forecasting around 60 to 65% coverage of amounts over half an inch. And on the higher end of the range, 2 inches, although some isolated swaths could pick up even higher totals if they're under the heavy thunderstorm activity for numerous hours.
Where should we be keeping an eye on globally? I guess Russia for sure.
Yeah, Russia continues to be very hot and under a significant drought. In fact, the Russian Meteorological Service just issued this past week that this some of the driest conditions over the past 3 months that's been observed in over 130 years of record keeping. So, you know, major deal for that area. And some of that dryness has also extended into portions of northern Europe. We're just going to see some relief here. Overall here, big picture-wise, it's really Russia and into the Kazakhstan, which is having the most significant heat and dryness issues.
Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome, Dave.
That's Mark Russo of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. And that is the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you, and online at willag.org, stay tuned for The Farming World. This is Dave Dickey. Thank you.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with a representative of the American Meat Institute. AMI is a national trade association that represents companies that process some 95% of red meat and 70% of turkey in the United States and their suppliers throughout America. Dave Ray is Vice President of Public Affairs for the American Meat Institute. Mr. Ray, thank you so much for being with us. Why don't you tell us first about the American Meat Institute and who funds it, who it represents, and what you do?
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to get to share some of what we're doing here in Washington and across the country with your listeners. AMI is America's oldest and largest meat and poultry trade association. By American standards, we're actually ancient. We were founded in 1906 in Chicago. We represent America's meat packers and processors. So for those of you who aren't in agriculture, by and large, we do not produce the animals that we eat. We purchase the animals and turn them into the meat we eat. So if you walk into the grocery store and you look at the meat case, by and large, those are are AMI's members representing red meats and turkey. We have been moved from Chicago to Washington, D.C. several decades ago and are located in downtown D.C.
And what is your primary function?
Our primary function is to represent the interests of the meat and poultry trade industry here in the United States, both in terms of domestic policies, in terms of legislation on Capitol Hill, regulations, if the government's considering regulations to the industry or legislation that's going to affect the industry one way or the other. Also to try to work... We have a vice president of international trade whose full-time job is really dedicated to working to open up markets because, as all of us know, most of the consumers on the world on the planet live outside of the U.S. borders, not inside of them. And so international trade is certainly a big issue for us. So we work on those issues and make sure the interests of meat and poultry packers and processors are represented well in Washington.
And do your members fund the organization, and how's that happen?
Yes, our members fund their membership is decided by the size of the company. We represent companies, you know, that are the largest meat packers and processors in the U.S. all the way down to your mom and pop shops that have maybe 2 to 3 employees. Their dues are determined by their sales and the volume of employees. And so we are funded by their dues.
And so what kind of companies would most people be familiar with that are members? For instance, I'm looking through some of it. Cargill, obviously a member. Purnell's, which makes sausage, people probably would... recognize that. Hormel, I see, as a member.
Yeah, so
Johnsonville
Brats,
all those sorts of things, right?
Yes, exactly. If you walk down the meat case and look, about 90% of the folks representing those packages there are going to be our members.
Yeah, so I see Kraft and Louis Rich.
That would be
Oscar Mayer and Louis Rich and all kinds of folks. Those are the people. Omaha Steaks is there for people that are shipping through the post mail.
Mm-hmm.
So you represent these organizations. You told me as we got started that one of the primary interests at this point was corn-based ethanol. What side do you take on this issue?
Well, we tend to be a very much a free trade, free market organization, meaning that, you know, we like to see as much of the government's interference out of the markets as possible. When it comes to the issue of corn-based ethanol, I think we probably all agree that America needs to be looking elsewhere for fuels. Instead of importing it from abroad, we need to be, you know, investing in biofuels and finding alternatives, domestic alternatives to purchasing and burning foreign oil. Where that becomes a problem, though, is when the government takes sides and decides that it's going to support one industry over another. And what happened in 2007 is that the government, in essence, created an entire new domestic market for corn-based ethanol because it mandated the amount of corn-based ethanol that was going to be that had to be blended into the gasoline supply. What it in effect did was create a whole new market for corn-based ethanol and diverted much of the corn that we use that we feed to our animals into the fuel supply. So instead of consuming corn, we now burn it. What that did in 2008, if you remember what corn prices did in 2008, some of them went up between $6 and $8 a bushel for some period of time and caused a lot of pressure on food and feed prices. For us in the meat and poultry industry, corn is the largest single input to the animals that are raised for human food. And so when the government makes a decision that it's going to take the corn supply and burn it, which by the time the ethanol mandate is finished, we will be burning 40% of the corn raised in the United States as additives to gasoline. So we're not talking about a small percentage of corn. Right now it's about a third of the corn supply we're burning. What that has done is to a number of things. It has placed it is at least nearly doubled for a set period of time the price of corn. So if you double an input, you're going to drive the price up. So the government has caused the doubling of corn price, near doubling of corn prices. It has created a new market that's going to have an ever expanding appetite for corn. And it's, by and large, going to be forcing consumers into a situation where they're going to have to decide whether they want to put fuel in their tanks or food on their table. We, you know, like I said, have support the formation of a very healthy and stable biofuels industry, but we question whether or not the government should be supporting one biofuel over another by giving corn this extra impetus. It's really been at the disadvantage of other competing biofuels. But secondly, and most importantly, is the question of whether or not it makes good sense and whether or not it's really ethical in the long run to be taking a large amount of your food supply and burning it in a world where there isn't an overabundance of food. And our burning our corn supply has global ramifications. So we have asked for, really what we're pushing for right now is a policy that would remove the subsidies for the corn-based ethanol industry. It's currently getting tax credits. And the government is also blocking the importation of ethanol from other countries. We could be importing. And so we're just saying, you know, remove the government support that the ethanol industry has had for 30 years. Let the industry compete on its own merit with other biofuel options and stop blocking possible imports from other countries. Let the market determine the cost of grain, not the government, and we'll all accept it and move forward from there.
Mr. Ray, I have a question, which is, do you really believe that the price of corn went to as high as it did into the $7 level in 2008 based off of fuel-based ethanol? I mean, crude oil doubled in that same time frame. Are you blaming Congress and Washington, D.C., for that impact, and are the two not related?
Well, obviously the two are related. Now that the price of corn has now been coupled with the price of oil, since it is considered another source of fuel, certainly the mandate to burn 30% of the corn supply to divert it into the gasoline tank did have some impact on the upward pressure of corn prices. I didn't say it was completely that, but it certainly was a major impact. And we don't see, you know, what's the problem with putting all your eggs in one basket, I mean, we support a portfolio approach to biofuels, corn-based ethanol, second and third generation biofuels. But the real question is whether or not we want to be burning a large portion of our food as fuel, and I think it just doesn't really make sense in the long run.
But if you take a look at total amount of corn that's been produced in the United States over time, while we are now approaching 30% that is going to produce ethanol, the amount of corn that's available has not run out and has not really come into short supply in any form, or very short supply. We haven't emptied the coffers at any point in time. I'm surprised that you're taking such a hard line, given that many of your members also would be users of corn for food products.
We are not taking, we are the corn farmers' best customer. We intend on remaining their best customer. Our beef is with corn-based ethanol. And whether it is really in the long-term best interest of this country to be burning its food supply. And we believe that the ethanol industry has had 30 years of government subsidies that were intended to get the industry on its feet, let it learn the ropes, and compete in the free market system. Enough is enough. Budgets are tight. The corn-based ethanol industry is going to make it, let it make it on its own. Furthermore, we believe in free and fair trade. We shouldn't be blocking ethanol imports from Brazil because our industry can't compete with them. If our industry is going to make it, it's going to make it without government help based on a free market scenario. That's all we're asking for.
Okay, good enough. Let's move on to other issues. The industry structure and the way it is put together. Part of this has to do with packer consolidation, I suppose. Other part has to do with vertical integration. Which side do you want to take up?
Well, honestly, this is a topic that the government is having seminars around the country to address these various issues, and without getting too deep into it, because I'm not really a policy expert in industry structure, one of the issues that we confront when this topic comes up every several years is whether or not the packers should be allowed to use any type of marketing agreements or contracts to partially own or control animals as they're coming into the process. And we've, believe strongly that marketing agreements are very favorable to both producers and packers, that it allows for cooperative agreements between producers and packers, and ultimately helps provide consumers with the type of meat products that they're wanting to buy. We believe these are tools that have been developed in the free market system, and they should be allowed to remain.
We're talking with the American Meat Institute's David Ray this afternoon. More on our conversation when we continue with The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, a new survey from the National Association for Business Economics says that the U.S. recovery has continued during the second quarter of this year, with more businesses hiring workers and fewer cutting jobs, but the pace of growth has slowed. 31% of businesses added workers between April and June, the highest level in 3 years, and 39% of those surveyed say they expect to hire more workers over the next 6 months, the most since January of 2008. The number of respondents who think real gross domestic product will expand by more than 3% this year slid to 20%, from the 24% who expected that rate of growth in April. The Russian Grain Union today says that Russia may still be able to export some 20 million tons of grain in the current crop year unless the drought-hit harvest falls below 81.5 million metric tons. Soaring temperatures across large parts of Russia since late June have destroyed nearly 10 million hectares of crops out of 48 million planted. Hasbro Incorporated says its second quarter profit rose 11% as its spending cuts outpaced the drop in sales. Hasbro says its profit grew to $43.6 million, or 29 cents per share, in the quarter that ended June 27th. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're on the phone line this afternoon with David Ray of the American Meat Institute. When we last talked with him, we were discussing vertical integration within the packer industry. Mr. Ray, I'm wondering if there are reasons that packers should not own animals.
Is there a reason for packers to not own the animals?
That's the question.
Not that I can think of.
Well, Is unfettered capitalism in this point good for democracy, do you think? I mean, in the idea that locally owned businesses are good for democracy and having ownership in the nation itself is good for democracy, and that very large organizations, whether it be a consolidated packer, and there aren't very many packers. How many packers do we have in the nation at this point?
The processing plants are broken into both federally and state-inspected plants, and together there are about 3,000 federally and state-inspected slaughtering plants in the U.S.
Right, but owned by how many companies, David?
I don't know that number.
How much of the meat goes through very few of those companies? Do you have an idea? I'm sure you do.
Yeah, there are both on the beef side and on the pork side, a very high percentage, upwards to about 80% of the packers process. I'm rifling through here. If you look at daily hog slaughter, you have about the top five companies account for about 65% of the total. If you have daily cow slaughter, you have the top four companies account for about 55% of the total. But that's leaves a lot of room for smaller companies. Our point is this, is that we're talking about a producer and a packer, a single producer who is looking to you can agree to not go into a marketing agreement, which many producers opt not to, particularly on the beef side, or you can decide to go into a marketing agreement. It's a way of hedging your risk. A marketing agreement allows you to team up with a packer to agree to a price in advance, whatever other types of specifics you want in your contract, and to deliver your product on a given date to the packer. What it does for the producer, it's a way of hedging risk. You can lock in your price in the distant future. It kind of protects you from fluctuating grain prices and so on. For the packer, what it does is, this is a manufacturing industry. It locks in a guaranteed supply of animals to keep your lines running. It also allows packers to try to set up what kind of specs they're trying to get from producers for the animals that they're producing, or for the meat that they're producing. A lot of the high-value meats that are being produced are your branded meats. And one thing that we see from consumers is that they like consistency in products. Well, how do you get a consistent product if you don't have an agreement between a packer and a producer on what kind of animal that they're going to produce, what the kind of the weight specs are going to be, and so on and so forth? So We honestly believe that these are the type of free marketing agreements that producers can opt in or opt out of that allow us to give the consumers the type of meat they want to purchase.
One final issue I know you wanted to take up, immigration reform. And you have been actively involved in immigration in the United States for quite some time. Is this correct? First, you spent 15 years as the chief media spokesman for the Federation for American Immigration Reform?
That's true, yes.
Right. So what's the American Meat Institute's take on immigration reform?
Well, we have been long supporters of comprehensive immigration reform. I mean, if you look back even to when the Institute was founded in 1906, the meatpackers and processing industry, it's always been a gateway industry for new immigrants. These are jobs that are largely don't require a high level of education. They're jobs that come in that even at the turn of the century till today, people with limited English can get their first step to the American dream. This is a lot of times very hard labor and very, you know, kind of meat locker, cold environment, sometimes wet. So by and large, some of these jobs are jobs Americans simply don't want to do. We've found that we've been blessed by being a gateway industry. But immigration reform is something that the country's going to have to get a handle on. We have been long supporters of comprehensive immigration reform, which includes border security. It includes the mandatory use of the E-Verify system, which would allow employers to validate whether or not a new employee is legally permitted to hold a job in the U.S. We've talked about trying to put forth a pathway to legalization for the people who are here and working already and paying taxes, to give them a way to legalize their status, and then for future worker needs, some form of guest worker program. Now, this is at this point kind of a policy position. I don't know what kind of hope comprehensive immigration reform has in this Congress. Former chairman of the RNC said this weekend, immigration is an issue where both sides lose. So I don't know, you know, what we're going to get out of comprehensive immigration reform, but that basically lays out what our position is on it.
Thank you so much for being with us. We're all out of time. I do appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
David Ray is a vice president of public affairs for the American Meat Institute. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.